would like to also welcome to oral arguments this morning, students from Sioux Falls Christian High School and Chester High School. The second case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Kenneth L. Martin. For the appellant, Mr. Martin, is Mr. Michael Stonefield from the Pennington County Public Defender's Office in Rapid City. For the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Jeffrey Tronvold, an Assistant Attorney General. You may proceed, Mr. Stonefield.
Please support counsel. Kenneth Martin was charged with first-degree murder for the shooting death of a man named Robert Ludeman in August of 2001. Mr. Martin pled not guilty by reason of insanity to the charges. He was tried by a jury in Pennington County in September of 2002. He was convicted of first-degree murder, sentenced to life in prison. I have raised four issues in the appellate's brief. I'm hoping to talk about two, possibly three of them. The first issue that I want to talk about is the issue that's listed as issue number one in the brief, and that is the issue about that arose out of jury selection. To put this in a little
bit. What are the other two that you hope to get to?
The third issue and the fourth issue.
Thank you.
To put the jury selection issue into context, after the attorney questioning, after the voir dire attorney questioning, and during the process of the parties using their peremptory challenges here, the state used its first peremptory challenge to strike a man. It then used its next 13 consecutive peremptory challenges to strike females. The defense raised an objection on the use of the 13th and the 14th strikes. We raised a challenge that lawyers commonly call a Batson challenge. Batson, of course, dealt with race. The issue here was gender, but gender, of course, is also a protected category. We challenged the state's use of these two peremptory challenges and argued that they were discriminatory, that they were gender-based, and that there was no legitimate non-discriminatory reason for the use for the striking of these two jurors. Procedurally, how this went, the trial judge, Judge Tice, asked the state to give a response to our challenge. The state gave a response. Judge Tice was satisfied with the response, said that he did not believe that we had met our showing of the challenge or of the strikes being gender-based, and he denied our motion, or denied our objection. The argument here is that the strike of one of these two, and I will concede that the two jurors that we objected to here, I'm only challenging the striking of one of them. The argument here on the first issue is that the strike of Juror Elliott was gender-based, was discriminatory, and violated the 14th Amendment as that issue has been framed by case law of the United States Supreme Court.
Just so that we set the stage for the background here, is it correct that the trial court judge had you seat 56 jurors, and then each of you were to strike 22 in order to arrive at the 12 jurors that would try the case?
Actually, to arrive at 14.
Pardon?
Actually, to arrive at 14 jurors, because there were two alternates.
Two alternates. Okay.
So, yes, we began with a pool of 56 people, and as you said, each side was given 22 strikes, and that brought us down to we must have began with 58, because we arrived at a number of 14, which included two alternates. So we must have began with 58.
All right, so if we take your argument, if we just take it on its face value, and the state, of course, you're not challenged on your 22 that you strike, are you?
I haven't been challenged, and I wasn't at trial.
Right.
No, that's right.
Okay. So if the state goes over on gender or goes over, strikes more women than men, as soon as they get over, theoretically you could make a challenge. If they go over on men, you could challenge that, couldn't you? So do they have to keep an exact proportion, the
no.
number of men and women?
No, not at all. Not at all. The way Batson procedure has been set up by the courts, and how I'd kind of like to walk through this issue because I think it makes the most sense, is to talk about the three-step procedure that's discussed in the case law, and then analyze what occurred at the trial court on each of the three steps here. The first step, when a Batson objection is made, or gender challenges in this case is made, the case law says procedurally that the first step that has to be, that the first burden that's on the challenger of the strike is to have established a prima facie case of discrimination. Now, I submit that was done here. And I can argue that it was done here, clearly done here, for two reasons. The first reason, that I don't think that my prima facie case is even an issue, is that it was not made an issue in front of the trial court. The trial court did not claim that I had not made a prima facie case. The trial court, after my record was made, simply asked the state's attorney to give a response.
What was your reason that you had made a prima facie case? The fact that there were 13 in a row that were stricken as women?
Yes, that was the record that
was made. Did you make any record other than that?
I don't know that I did.
Mr. Stonefield, though, as I read the record, you conceded in your brief that many of those 13 women that were struck, there were valid reasons other than gender.
Oh, absolutely.
For removing it. So what was your reasoning? If the first 13 were struck for valid reasons, why is it that it came to your attention as to 13 and 14?
I'm not saying that all 13 women who were struck, that there were non-gender, non-discriminatory reasons. I'm saying that there were for some. And I agree, I didn't make an objection to every single woman who had been challenged here. But I don't believe that the case law requires me to do that. I think what's required here is simply that I show a discriminatory motive to the striking of even a single juror. Now, getting back to walking through the steps of the challenge here, the prima facie case, I think, was made because it's clear that they had struck 13 consecutive females. That's separate, though, from what I think is really the issue, why we don't focus on the prima facie case here. And that's because, as I was saying, it wasn't raised in front of Judge Tice. Judge Tice didn't say that a prima facie case hadn't been made. The state's attorney didn't say that it hadn't been made. Judge Tice simply said to the state's attorney, present your reasons for the strike. And the case law says...
Excuse me, the record doesn't appear to be disputed on this. It looks to me like the only question is the third step of the Batson analysis.
I think that's true.
And that's whether or not you as the defendant have carried your burden of demonstrating pretext or purposeful discrimination.
Yes, I think that's true. I think we're past the first step. The second step requires a facially non-discriminatory reason given by the party objecting to the challenge. And I will concede that on its face, the reason that they gave to the trial court, or reasons as to Juror Elliott, I will concede that on their face, they were facially non-discriminatory. The reasons given were her age, her marital status that she'd been divorced, and her answers on a pretrial jury questionnaire, which had gone out to all prospective jurors. Part of the question, or one of the questions, or two or three of the questions on that document involved or asked for responses about people's attitudes toward insanity, the insanity defense. third step here. In the second step of the test, a reviewing court simply looks to see whether the reasons given, as I said, were facially non-discriminatory. It doesn't go beyond that. It doesn't go to the validity of the reasons. You go to the validity of the reasons, whether they're valid, what's really behind them. You go to that in the third step. And in the third step, the case law says that the reasons given by the, in this case, the prosecutor, have to be related to the issues being tried, in addition to being to not being discriminatory. How do you determine this? What standard do you use here? Well, the case law talks about, and I've cited this in, I think, in a number of cases in my brief, you can show that the party's use of the strike or their rationale for the strike was pretextual or simply an excuse, a reason to try to mask what really was discrimination. You can show that it was pretextual by looking at whether there was disparate treatment in the use of the strikes. In other words,
did you argue to the trial court that there was a reason to tell the state was kicking off the...
Did I give a specific reason why I thought they did?
Give the trial court an opportunity to fully weigh what the state says the reasons are, and do you have a counter to that, or are you just to say, well, he's kicking off?
No, I don't believe that I gave them a specific reason for why I believed they were excusing women. But I don't.
Protection of your record?
Pardon?
Is that them an adequate protection of your records, or are you not offering
well,
a position as to allow the trial court to weigh the reasons that they make a decision?
First of all, a reason wasn't called for by the trial judge. The state's attorney at the time of the trial didn't argue that, again, that I hadn't made my prima facie case, and it wasn't argued by the attorney general in the briefing here that the prima facie case hadn't been made. The reason, I think, is any more than a reason for a discriminatory strike against race. I don't know that a party, I don't know that case law says that a party has to give or has to say something beyond the fact that they're striking people for a racial reason. I don't know that you have to say, well, they're striking because of a racial reason because they think that black people aren't as smart as white people or something like that. And I think the same logic would apply on this issue. I think we can infer here, if we find that there was a discriminatory intent.
What does the trial judge do if the state defends itself, saying, well, this is the reason, Your Honor, that we are striking these potential jurors, and the defense sits there silent and doesn't offer any explanation to counter the state's argument?
Well, I don't think that I didn't offer any explanation. I talked about the factors that they talked about. I talked about age. And in my brief, I've shown you from the record here that age was pretextual because of the fact that they left on a man who was older than Juror Elliott.
And you argued all of those things to the trial court?
I think I did.
And how many other jurors fit those that profile that the state did not eliminate as jurors?
Well, there was a man who was older than the female juror who they excluded, a man who sat on the jury. There was a man who was divorced who sat on the jury. That was their other rationale for striking this juror. The third rationale, her questionnaire answers, I think in my brief I talked about and compared questionnaire answers given by four other jurors that I submit were completely indistinguishable from the questionnaire answer given by the juror who they struck.
Did those jurors meet each of the distinguishing criteria, not just gender one of them in each case?
I can't tell you that they did, and you know that's the state's primary defense of the challenge here. And in response to that, first of all, they didn't argue to the trial court that there was some combination of factors here, which is why they were they were looking for an ideal juror that had a combination, or their ideal juror did not have this particular combination of marital status, age, and questionnaire answer. They didn't argue that. But secondly, and I think this is significant, I think they are conceding by the fact that they're arguing this combination argument, I think they're conceding that each of the issues, each of the reasons that they gave by itself was pretextual. I think they're conceding that.
Well, if we use comparison analysis, don't we have to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges?
They did not, I believe, did not cite any cases dealing with this, specifically with this issue, which said that you take the factors all together, and if one factor isn't present in the mix of the juror, that is a valid reason for striking the person. There's no cases that they cited that I believe said that.
What's your belief? I mean, should we apply, should we compare apples to apples, or?
If each of the reasons by itself is pretextual, each of the reasons by itself is not related to the facts of the case being tried, how can you combine them and they then justify the strike? How can they not be pretextual in combination if they're pretextual individually?
For the benefit of the audience, if you prevail on this argument, that there is one juror that should have been allowed to serve that didn't, what's your remedy?
Remedy is a new trial.
Okay.
And I don't believe that harmless error analysis even applies to this issue. And I think that's covered in the briefs. I know that my time is running short, and I do want to talk about the issue that's labeled as issue three in the briefs. And that issue deals with the jury instruction. Now, during the settling of jury instructions here, I proposed to the trial judge that he give an instruction that I've termed consequence instruction, because what it would have done was explain to the jurors the consequence of a not guilty by reason of insanity verdict. The trial judge denied that instruction. During the course of the trial, there were three specific comments made, and I've cited them in the briefs. One was made during voir dire, two were made during closing argument, to the effect of, the only verdict that would hold Mr. Martin accountable here is a guilty verdict. He won't be accountable under any other verdict.
Did you answer that in your final argument or opening statements?
I don't believe that it was talked about at all because we were not given an instruction. I think had I gotten into that, I would have been shut down, I think. Clearly this issue was very significant in this case. This was, I believe, a significant insanity defense presented in this case. And the state was ready to meet the objection to the instruction here, and they did meet it, or they met it to Judge Tice's satisfaction. And so, no, we didn't argue that. I don't believe that we would have been allowed to.
You did object, though, each time it was raised by the state.
Yes.
And
yes,
those were sustained?
They were all sustained, yes.
And the evidence was stricken, and the judge admonished the jury to disregard.
He admonished them during the first objection during the closing argument.
2 minutes, Mr. Stonefield.
He admonished them at that point. After the second objection, which followed quickly on the heels of the first, Judge Tice took us out of the courtroom so that we could make the record. Took us out of the courtroom and made the record that we made in chambers. And we came back into the courtroom, and I reviewed the transcript on this again. It does not appear that there was any kind of admonishment or striking of the second comment when we came back into the courtroom. Now, the state here has argued that there's no prejudicial error, they've argued here that, first of all, they've argued that the comments were not even erroneous. And I think that that's just clearly wrong. I think Judge Tice's response here was the more reasoned response, that they were erroneous. The question is whether they were prejudicial, and the question for you, of course, is whether they constitute reversible error. If we look at what was said here, in the context of what was said, no accountability unless you find him guilty. Now, that argument and the full argument that was made here, I'll concede, was not as glaring or not as flagrant as it could have been. It wasn't to the effect of you acquit him by reason of insanity and he'll move in next door to you next week and he'll be your neighbor. It wasn't that. But it was not innocuous either, as the Attorney General in the brief had attempted to say, that it was simply something made in passing with no potential impact on the jury here. I don't think that's a fair characterization of it at all.
He came back to it three times, even though he was instructed twice not to,
yes,
right?
Yes. What it was, though, and the heart of this issue, what it was false.
Your time has expired, Mr. Stonefield. Thank you. Mr. Trotwell, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please the court, counsel. My name is Jeff Trotwell. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here to represent the state in this matter. While it was the defense that Martin was insane, that he was delusional at the time he committed this crime, I would like to go over just a few facts to point out that was not necessarily supported in the record. Before, during, and after this crime, his behaviors did not support the diagnosis of a delusional disorder. Prior to the crime, he made a silencer, he waited until dark, he apparently waited outside Ludeman's home, and then waited for Ludeman to walk out where he shot him at point-blank range. Instead of waiting to try and save Robbie Ludeman, he fled the scene, which basically his delusion was that he was doing this, or his alleged delusion was, he was doing this to raise Robbie Ludeman from the dead. He did not do that. He ran. He left Rapid City, destroyed evidence. The next day he told his sister he had destroyed the gun to the point where it would not be found, and he believed he had been identified, and so he told his sister he was going to call the police and play dumb. He called the police to turn himself in and then found out that he was not identified, but actually was not even a suspect, and his sister testified he became very upset when he found that out. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, and in the alternative second-degree murder, he was convicted of first-degree murder, and the appellant now appeals raising four issues.
Would you remind me, on the final jury, what was the makeup of the jury?
It was, on the final 14, it was 7 men and 7 women, and after the alternates were removed, it was 6 men and 6 women. And so it turned out to be completely even. On the first issue, the Batson challenge, it's important to remember the standard of review. The three-part test, as I understand it, is really for the trial court to consider, and it comes down to a factual finding. This court in State versus Farmer, I believe it was, said that the finding of purposeful discrimination is a finding of fact. And under Batson, it appears that in the third step of the Batson procedure, the judge makes a credibility determination as to whether the reasons given by the party, in this case the state, were persuasive, whether he believed that the state is being forthright with the answers given. It's clear from the record that the answers given were gender neutral. And it's also clear that not one of the other jurors on the panel had these three characteristics. Mr. Stonefield has said that I did not cite authority that you need to show apples and apples. However, Batson versus Kentucky and JB versus Alabama both say the test is very slight. Batson and JB were adopted as very narrow exceptions to the general rule that peremptory challenges were unquestionable and unreviewable, basically. The court in those cases said we don't have to rise to the level of a challenge for cause. We only need to show that there's something about this juror that makes her a little bit less acceptable than some of the others on the panel. These three characteristics combined make her distinguishable from the other 12 jurors on the panel, and therefore we can't really compare age with, you know, someone who is over 70 with someone who is divorced. And we have one.
Did the trial court use that as the analysis or the reasoning of ruling in favor of the state on that challenge? That the three combined, did the trial court address it, or did the trial court go into the reasons why it was not pretext?
I don't believe the court went into the details of its decision.
And the state didn't argue that the three combined, or did they argue to the judge that the three combined made her different?
Well, the state said that we have three reasons. He said that, the defense has already explained those three reasons. The defense responded by saying, well, we have many on the panel over 70, and there turned out to be one. And he said, her answer is no different than the other 120 answers in the questionnaire. And at that time, the defense didn't say anything about the fact that there turned out to be one other male who was divorced. And that was the response of the defense. And the court said, well, I don't see where there's purposeful discrimination here, and the objection was overruled.
What was it about her answer that showed that she may not be favorable objectively on an objective basis?
I don't know if it
was favorable to the insanity defense.
I don't know if it was so much that she was not favorable. I believe Mr. Brenner said it's not necessarily a bad answer. I believe it was probably a neutral answer. And I think Mr. Brenner said, I just like others a little bit better than I like this one.
Well, that doesn't sound to me like a very good reason to exclude someone for a non-gender reason, if it's simply neutral.
However, I guess I would say that if there are other jurors who had answers that the state's attorneys liked better, that made hers a little bit less acceptable than some of the others. That, and then combined with the other
would
two
criteria.
Would
this have been a different result if you'd not been using the strike down system, where the state's attorney knew he could weigh better versus maybe not so good because he had a certain number of people he was mandated to kick?
Right.
Would we get a different result if under the other system where you're not required to use preempts, you're just you go to both sides, either exhaust or they weigh?
Perhaps. I think originally Mr. Brenner made a general statement before giving us three reasons that, look, you know, we have to use up 21 or 22 challenges. These are the three reasons I gave for her, but, you know, I think he alluded to that when he was talking to Judge Tice in chambers.
And nothing prevents the defense, every time you strike a woman, nothing prevents the defense from striking a man to kind of counterbalance it, does
certainly.
It? And of course, you can't challenge their strikes because it would just result in a mistrial, and then you'd have to start all over again, wouldn't you?
I imagine. I mean, the state could object. The state can raise that challenge just like the defense, but
where's it going to get you?
Exactly. We start from scratch then.
Is there ever an analysis at this point of the totality of the circumstances? And because there's a lot of history here, that all the strikes on both the first trial and the second trial by the state were against women.
Right. And I think that goes into that third step where the judge makes his credibility decision. And in this case, Mr. Stonefield did say, when he originally made the objection, that there was a disproportionate number on the first jury panel that had been excluded. His background, there was originally a mistrial. There was a jury selected in a mistrial, and then this was actually the second jury seating. And when he initially made the objection in chambers, he said that he raised that to the trial court. And I think that taking into the totality of the circumstances, really, for the trial court on that third step, and then when it gets on appeal, it's basically a credibility determination, whether or not the trial court's decision was
clearly erroneous. Is that
certainly.
The review?
Certainly. Going on to the third issue, the defense is asking for a narrow exception in this case to Robinson. In issue two, he asked this court to reverse Robinson. He did not address that in his statement, so I will rely on my brief and my authorities for that issue. In the third issue, he asked that even if Robinson is upheld and the instruction cannot be read automatically, in certain cases, the instruction could be read if the jury is misled. Interestingly enough, when the parties went outside the presence of the jury, he raised this issue, asked again for the instruction. The trial court never cited Robinson. The trial court actually applied the rule that the defense is asking for here. The defense seems to say that if the statements had been had actually misled the jury that he would have read the instruction. However, he doesn't say that. He says that, I'm not going to let you talk about accountability, but the statements so far do not rise to the level of requiring an additional instruction in this case. So even if this court were to adopt the rule that the defense is asking for, he still doesn't get a new trial because the court has already applied that rule and found it did not apply in this case.
But this is a powerful piece of evidence that, or some, I shouldn't say evidence, but it's a powerful piece of information that the jury is not aware of. I mean, in this case, the defendant, he didn't deny killing him. I mean, he admitted to that, so his only defense was the insanity. And without the jury knowing that he would not walk out free, it is a powerful piece of information that's kept from the jury, which is different than the penalty. It's not a penalty. It's actually if he's acquitted, what happens, as opposed to if he's convicted, what happens. So this is highly prejudicial, is it not, if the jury doesn't know that?
Well, I don't believe so. In State versus Robinson, as well as United States versus Shannon, the United States Supreme Court case on this very issue, they both discussed that and said, if we give the instruction that the defense is asking for, which would be as to 23A.26.12, saying that you will be mandatorily committed in the federal system, it's the Insanity Defense Reform Act, where the defendant is automatically held pending a hearing, if found not guilty by reason of insanity. Robinson Court said that we would also have to allow the state to instruct the jury on SDCL 23.26.12.5, which is the criteria for the defendant's release. In this case, as a hypothetical, if the jury had accepted the defense expert's diagnosis in this case, the theory of the defense was that he was insane at the moment he pulled the trigger, but as soon as he pulled the trigger, a light switch went on and the delusion disappeared, which would be telling the jury that he will be mandatorily committed, but under 23.26.12.5, there would be no reason for the hospital administrator to hold him because, according to the defense, he's no longer a danger. And so I call it the can of worms argument. The Robinson Court talked about this. It's, we're better off instructing the jury not to consider what happens, whether it's guilt, innocence, or not guilty by reason of insanity, than to open up this whole line of thought for the jury.
What instruction, or was there an instruction then that the court gave at the end that sort of directed the jury not to consider?
Yes. They were instructed not to consider the consequences. I don't know the exact wording, but yes.
Did the instruction use the word consequences?
I don't know. It may have been punishment. I'm not sure.
You agree, though, don't you, that the final argument talking about accountability was improper? An objectionable final argument.
The trial court found that, and that was a finding of fact, and so I proceeded on the appeal as if that it was. I think Judge Tice was being cautious, and I believe that an argument can be made, but I can't make that because it's basically a finding of fact, and we can't argue that on appeal. But even if the judge found that it was inappropriate, he still said it did not rise to the level of needing this additional instruction.
Is this a discretionary decision then that the court needs to make depending upon the circumstances of each case?
Yes. And I think the defense alluded to this, that the statements here probably were not to the level of the ones that he cited in his brief. In those cases, they were telling the jury, don't give this guy a license to kill, don't let him walk out of this courtroom with the rest of us, don't let him get away with murder. I mean, the state's statements didn't even come near to approaching that.
Now, the defense ran out of time before it got to issue four, but I'd like to have you tell us why the trial court judge was correct in denying Martin's proposed jury instructions on defining the term wrongfulness.
Certainly. The standard of review here is abuse of discretion, whether or not the trial court erred in instructing or reading a proposed instruction. First of all, the trial court said there was eight instructions that explained to the jury what it needed to decide in reference to not guilty by reason of insanity. The judge said, Judge Tice said that to read this additional instruction would probably only be confusing to the jury in addition to the instructions already read. And so I guess he believed it would be more harm than good at that point. Furthermore, the testimony really centered around this issue of the difference between illegality and wrongfulness. Each party, each of the expert witnesses, one for the state and also for the defense, said that Martin understood what he was doing was illegal. And both attorneys went further to elicit testimony on whether there was their opinion was that in addition to illegality, that he understood the wrongfulness of his actions. And so I guess I would say that by the time the jury heard that term in the instructions, it would have been clear that illegality was not enough. Dr. Franks specifically testified that his opinion was that he was, not only did he understand the illegality, but also the wrongfulness. That was
at... Just a minute, though. Dr. Frank's testimony would be irrelevant to this question because whether or not you're entitled to a jury instruction depends on the evidence that you submitted in support of your claim, not based on what the state's evidence might have been. So the question is, did the defense put on evidence that would have justified that type of jury instruction?
Certainly.
So let's talk about Dr. Manlove.
Okay. Yes, Dr. Manlove believed that that the defendant did not understand the wrongfulness. He said that he believed that what he was doing was illegal, but that since he was working for God, basically, that people would, after he succeeded, people would think that he had done good, I guess, is for lack of a better way of putting it. On page 32 of my brief, I cited several pages where this issue was brought up. I didn't specify which party was presenting the testimony. I believe I have about 35 or 40 pages cited where this issue was brought up by the two expert witnesses.
Let me ask you the question this way then. The instruction that was requested by the defendant was something to the effect that moral or societal approval of this kind of conduct should be used by the jury in making its decision. Did Dr. Manlove ever present testimony based on that kind of a standard, moral approval, societal approval, or did Dr. Manlove restrict his testimony to right and wrong?
I believe it went into the moral aspect. I can't say for sure at this point. But
well, if Dr. Manlove express an opinion based on moral standards, then why shouldn't they get an instruction based on that?
I believe that the trial court found that as a whole, the instructions properly stated and informed the jury, and that it would be more confusing to read the instruction than to not read the instruction. And in addition, I guess on appeal, I'd argue that even if these instructions had been read, that the outcome would have not been different, that the testimony was very clear that this was the issue. And at that, I guess I have nothing further. I would...
Nobody's penalized for quitting early.
In conclusion, I would just like to ask this court, based on my brief as well as our discussion here, that you affirm the conviction of Ken Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Tranbold. Mr. Stonefield, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Stonefield, I want to make sure I'm right on this. You know, I didn't really see anything in the briefs that suggested Dr. Manlove gave an opinion based on societal or moral approval. And Mr. Tranbold, we just spoke about that. What's your recollection of the record on that?
Dr. Manlove, I believe, testified that Mr. Martin had told him that if society understood why he did this, if it saw the situation as he saw it, that he was actually going to be helping this man by killing him, showing him hell, which was the idea in his head, that he could kill him, show him hell, raise him from the dead, he would become alive again, he would live a better life, and he would be saved at the end of his natural life. Dr. Manlove's testimony, as I recall it, was that Ken Martin told him this, and Dr. Manlove believed that Ken Martin believed that. And so I think that's relevant to the question that you're asking, because on the fourth issue here, I guess the point that I would want to make on this more than anything else, and why I think this is so significant, that issue is so significant and prejudicial, is that without the instruction that were requested based on the Connecticut cases, without that instruction, the state was able to argue here, and did argue in its closing argument, something that any defense lawyer knows is as powerful an argument as can be made, that the defendant's own words convicted him. That the defendant, by the things he said during the course of the investigation or during the course of the case leading up to the trial, that he convicted himself. He showed his own guilt by what he said. And they argued that here. They argued his own words were, he knew what he did was wrong. And I agree. He told Dr. Manlove and he told Dr. Franks, yes, I knew it was wrong, but the context, that what he was talking about there, using the word wrongfulness, was that it was criminal. And we had no definition, no distinction between the terms, no instruction that told this jury that something being wrongful is not equal to it simply being illegal. We conceded, he conceded to both experts that he knew that this was illegal. He knew it was criminal or wrong in that sense. But did he know that society would have disapproved of it? Had society seen his actions from the from his own conceitedly mentally ill point of view? No, well, he didn't agree with that.
Let me ask you this, though. The legislature has set forth the wrongfulness standard. They've said that's the test for mental illness. Do we, as a court, have the authority under separation of powers to adopt a new standard other than straight wrongfulness?
I don't,
i.e. a standard of moral culpability?
I don't think we would be adopting a new standard so much as we'd simply be defining a term that's used in the statutes. And that's done all the time. I mean, courts, statutes, the legislature uses terms that are that need further definition regularly. And that's what we would be doing here, you as a court would be doing. You'd be further defining the term wrongfulness, which is used in the insanity definition in Title 22. We may be expanding it or limiting, we may be altering, I don't know that that's fair to say, altering. We're further defining it. We're making it more clear than it is. And the circumstances of this case, and the second Connecticut case that I cited, I believe it was a 2000 case, the second Connecticut case that I cited, specifically, I think was really close to on point to this factual situation. In that case, the court said, this factual situation where you've got a distinction between somebody where you've got a situation where someone may know the wrongfulness, the criminality of the act, but not see it as morally or societally wrong, is going to be an unusual situation. And I think that's very true. I think it is going to be an unusual situation, but it was this situation. It was this case. And that's why that instruction or some type of further defining instruction was needed here, and the fact that it wasn't given was seriously prejudicial. As to the third issue, I had started to talk about this before I had to sit down before, and Justice Meyer Henry, I wrote down something that you said when you were talking about that. That this consequence information is a powerful piece of information that the jury is not aware of. Absolutely. Now, I know that you as a court have, in the late 1980s, said that this information does not need to be given to a jury. And I've argued in a separate issue in the brief, and I'm not intending that that issue be waived, that you overrule State versus Robinson. But even if you choose not to do that, case law from both courts on the one side, jurisdictions that say you don't have to give this instruction, and jurisdictions on the other side that say absolutely you must give it, or at least the trial court has discretion to give it. When you've got a situation like we have here, where a party has injected into the jury's consciousness false information about the consequence, both sides come together here and they say that this instruction in certain cases needs to be given where misleading, or I believe in this case just outright false information, was given to the jury. In thinking about how to talk about this issue, I think to myself, in what context have you said that a party can not only attempt to prevent relevant information from coming to the jury's knowledge, not only attempt to prevent it, and here they did prevent it, but then, it having been prevented from the jury hearing it, argue falsely about it?
What about the answer, though, that it opens a can of worms? Then you have to explain further exactly what happens and how they're determined, how a defendant might then be determined whether he's held or whether he's released later.
I drafted an instruction here, a proposed instruction that's in the record. I think it was taken from the statutes. I think that it fairly represents the procedure here. The state at the time of trial and on appeal has not said that it was an inaccurate statement of the law. It talks about if there's an acquittal by reason of insanity, there's a mandatory commitment. The defendant then, or the committed person then, has the burden. The burden goes to that person to prove that they are capable, or to prove that their condition has improved to a point to a court's satisfaction that they should be eligible for release. Now, does that give complete and total information about the procedure? Does it explain all the minute details of the procedure? No, I would concede that it doesn't. But it's far better than what happened here. It's far more fair than what happened here. And this was fundamentally unfair to have allowed this argument to have been made and unrebutted. And again, coming back to the context of this, the closing argument, the context of this closing argument, the statement is made, an objection is made, it's sustained, and the state's attorney then goes right back to the issue again. This is a closing argument in a murder trial. This is the end of a day, end of many days of testimony, a heated situation. The trial judge felt that this situation was severe or important enough to remove the parties from the courtroom. We're out of the courtroom for a long enough period to make 5 full pages of transcript record here. And then we come back into the courtroom and nothing is said, nothing is explained. It's just proceed, counsel. And counsel admonished not to continue along these lines.
Your time has expired, Mr. Stanfield. Thank you. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.